Protoblog Podcast, episode number 401. I'm joined this week by Mike Harley and Chris Pockert, and we talk about the 2015 Ford F-150, the Ferrari F60 America, and the Tesla Model S D-Trim. That's all ahead on episode 401 of the Autoblog Podcast. Hello, welcome to Autoblog Podcast number 401. I am Dan Roth. I'm joined this week by Mike Harley.
Hello, guys.
And Chris Pockert.
I missed 400 by this much.
I know.
I'm thinking the same thing. I'm a little angry that I wasn't invited last
week. Mike, you weren't around last week. And Chris, I think it was the same thing with you. You were not
around. Can we call this 400.1?
I don't think that's
right. He doesn't want to. It's going to mess things up. Version
2.0? Something.
Right. Yeah. If you were to go to 400.1, that would imply that we're doing one per day, and that's a different thing. I'd be down with that.
25 years from now, when we're at podcast 10,327, everyone's going to say, why is there a 0.1 back in 2014?
Yeah, nobody will get it. This one, I know it's a couple of days later than usual, but we're busy. We've been busy. You guys have been all over the place. Chris went to hell, and Mike, you've been around on a few different things. So, let's start with the garage. We'll start with executive editor, Mr. Pockert. What are you driving this week?
Well, as you mentioned, I've driven all kinds of stuff this week, but the thing that is assigned to me for the week is the new Chevy Colorado.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, you guys are going to laugh. Guess what I'm driving this week? I've got a Colorado.
What awesome. Trim do you have?
I've got the Colorado four-wheel drive Z71 Crew Long Box.
And how much is yours?
$36,500.
Ah, it's Silverado money.
$36,535?
Yes.
We're driving the same truck.
What color is yours?
Mine is I don't know what the official color is, but it's charcoal.
Oh, shit. It's called Cyber Gray Metallic. I've got it in my driveway.
That's probably the same truck.
Chris,
why don't you go ahead and I'll go back to last week's car or something.
It is Cyber Gray Metallic over a jet black interior.
Jet black interior? Of course it is.
Yeah.
With a V6?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Six-speed auto, 3.6 liter.
Tell us about the car because I'm excited to hear about it.
Since you're clearly not aware, this is the new quote-unquote mid-size truck with 305 horsepower, 269 foot-pounds of torque. It is a nice entry into the segment. I've actually spent a lot of time driving all the different variants of both Canyon and Colorado this week, the Canyon being the GMC Twin, in both the four-cylinder and V6 trims. And it's great to have some fresh blood in this segment. I like it quite a bit. I'm a former compact pickup truck owner, and I think that there is a market for these sorts of things. I think a lot of the reason why the market seems to have gone away, if you look at the numbers, is the fact that there's been no incentive for people to buy new ones because you're basically buying a brand new 10-year-old truck. And this feels like a modern vehicle. It has a sort of a baby Silverado interior. It's quite refined inside. It's still a very large truck, so it's as large as a full-size truck was just a couple of years ago, especially in this four-door configuration. So it doesn't feel terribly small. The biggest thing that you notice, I think, about it, at least to me, is the narrower width.
I remember when this thing debuted, and I was all excited. I really like the looks. I mean, it's got a really nice muscular. It doesn't look. Remember the compact trucks of a decade ago always looked miniaturized, and they always looked a little softer and not as burly and muscular. This thing's got a nice stance. I mean, the UPS guy drove up the hill today and stopped in front of my driveway, and I was all excited because I was thinking I was getting a package. He gets out, walks around the Colorado, and jumps back into his brown UPS truck and drives away.
Did he linger?
No, he just did a big quick mirror. He's on the clock. So he just did this circle, and I kept thinking, where's my package? And then he drove away, and I was kind of bummed. And that almost never happens. I mean, the guy knows that I'm in new cars every week. But it's a good-looking truck, and, mine mirrors yours, obviously. I like the interior. It drives really, really well. I mean, I drove it out to probably put – 200 or 300 miles on it in the past couple of days. Just a lot of highway stuff. It rides well. I've got the Z71 suspension, as do you, I'm sure. And it's a little bumpy, but it didn't get to the point where after an hour it was grating on me and I says, oh my gosh, I'm in a pickup truck. It was comfortable. Steers well. Brakes are impressive.
There's really good initial pedal feel, right? I mean, it's responsive. It's not sagging at all. Yeah.
And it stops well. I mean, I was going down a hill today at a good probably 40 or 50 miles an hour, and it was one of those lights that turned yellow, and I'm like, and then it turned red. I said, you know, it's 5 o'clock. A lot of cars are on. I'll stop. And I hit them hard.
Just once. I'll stop.
No, it's one of those things. Do I run a long yellow or do I stop early on the yellow? And it was one of those things, you know, everyone's – a lot of commuters out. You know, I'll jam on the brakes double hard and stop. And there was – normally in a pickup truck, you expect the back end to get a little light and squirrely. And no, it's nice. The I don't know if the projector headlight lenses are standard with just halogen lights. Lights are good. I like the tailgate, the easy lift and lower. I like headlocks. The only thing I don't like is I'm not a huge fan of that engine transmission. And I've heard rumors that Chevy is still tuning the transmission software, you know, to make it a little better. So,
I mean, it sounds like overall it's a pretty good truck, but the
question.
I was just going to say the question I have is like it's 36K.
Yeah. But you don't have to get it. I mean, I think the way both of ours are optioned, it's sort of like let's show them what the all wheel drive, the sport, you know, the off road suspension. We've got a long box, we've got the crew cab. I mean, this pretty decked out.
Mine has the MyLink audio with 8-inch navigation screen, premium Bose audio, and trailer equipment package.
Chris, I wouldn't.
Which I'm sure yours is exactly the same way.
I wouldn't be surprised if we have the same VIN number and Chevy counted as one unit too. I mean, do you have the Monroney in front of you?
Are you in Clarkston, Michigan right now? In my driveway. No.
Would that be funny for sure? Same car.
I do actually. I have I have the window sticker.
What are the last five digits?
17667.
Okay, so I'm 17484. So we're a couple hundred off.
Yeah. But
that's funny. There'll be a lot of great cars. Great truck.
So just out of curiosity, I decided to try and build a 2014 Silverado. With similar options. Now, obviously, this is sort of an apples and orange comparison, but a 1500 crew cab with the short box rear-wheel drive starts at $34,795. And if you want to get the Z71 package and you want to get navigation and the Bose audio, you're looking at $45,290. That's before discounts. And right now, there's $5,000 off. So you're only looking at $40,262 before haggling. So... you know, that's not a very big gulf if you take into account the incentives.
And trade, yeah. I mean, that's...
From $36,535 to $40,262, that's a little troublesome. But I think, if you compare MSRPs, which is probably really the only fair way to do it at this point because we don't know what incentives are going to be launched with this truck out of the box, that's a pretty decent-sized difference. You know, almost $10,000, and I think I've heard them say in a lot of models and trims the difference is $6,000 to $7,000, and that's not insubstantial.
Yeah, no, I'll agree with that, and I think too the other thing that you'll find is that price parity or difference aside, some people just don't want a Silverado. They just don't want a truck that big.
Right. Well, and as we've heard, Seth did the first drive of this truck, and he mentioned that Chevy really thinks that they can go kind of after the crossover market. And if you drove something like a Tacoma or Frontier, even a brand new one, you would laugh and look at the differences in terms of relative civility and fuel economy and available options and such. But you can make a pretty decent argument. This is a pretty quiet truck, quite comfortable. It doesn't have the same level of ride refinement, I would agree, especially this Z71. But it's not that far off that you couldn't make the sacrifice if you wanted to.
But it doesn't do the things that in a positive way, it doesn't do all the things that annoy me typically with a pickup truck. You know, the interior's nice, it steers well, it brakes well. I mean, and those are the things normally you're like, okay, I'm in a pickup truck, I can feel I'm in a pickup truck. And like you said, this thing drives much more like a crossover. I mean, it's
there's no bed shake. I was driving on some truly terrible roads, dirt and paved. And, you know, the back end is not bouncing around, even though I drove it completely unladen. And it's a nice truck. And I drove the four-cylinder version as well, you know, in the extended cab format. And that was nice as well. And it's a little wheezy. And I'd have to see how it performs with something in the back. But it was perfectly acceptable, and I think on the lower end, this is a truck that tends to make a lot more sense than, you know, fully loaded.
Yeah, well, and I think that's going to see, like, all the fleets driving. That's going to be the commercial special with the magnetized sign on the door.
I'm excited to see the diesel when they roll it out.
Although I think did you guys talk with anybody at GM at all, or did they? I forget. I think they're trying to keep it kind of out of fleets, right? They're not looking to load it up with sort of institutional volume, as it were. They want to see what this truck is going to do when they float it out on the sort of open market, if I recall.
Well, I think that's always the line. And of course, there's good fleet and bad fleet. You know, bad fleet being things like rental car agencies, you know, where they're going to just beat the hell out of them and then they're going to dump them on the market en masse. And then there's ones where the margins are more favorable and the deals are a little bit smaller. And I think, you know, they're still going to need fleet out of this truck. That's just going to happen. But
I agree with Chris. I agree with Chris. You know, it's a good fleet is a city buying 20, you know, copies. Bad fleet is a Hertz rent a car buying 10,000, and they're all going to come off lease the same month.
Yeah, but I mean, and you know, I don't think any automaker is going to turn down a company like Verizon or something buying a whole bunch for their people either. And they now have, you know, a new option where you pointed at the Frontier and the Tacoma. Like, the Frontier is hilariously quaint. I love it, but it's really like a. It's like driving an anvil at this point.
Yeah.
It's
just, well, and the Tacoma, too, to be fair. I drove one of those last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, just for a couple of nights. And then we had a Tacoma out at Truck of the Year testing today, and I sat in it. And it's like hot tub time machine, man. Yeah. The difference is just night and day. It really is.
The splay legs posture. I love that about the
Tacoma. Well, to get into the four-wheel drive, it's like, it's up really high, kind of like the C71, and you duck low to get in and a little in. So it's weird, and then it's legs out, and you're sitting lower to the floor than you expect, and just all the dated plastics and just the engine noise and the bed shake, and it just feels like a much, much older, less sophisticated machine, which of course it is.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's redone their trucks in this segment for like a decade.
Yeah,
but Chris, the thing that blows me away the most is probably the chassis.
You
know, I mean, the chassis is really, really good, and you notice that right away, like you say, with a bed shake. Usually, you drive down a rutted road, and you look in the rearview mirror, and the bed's going one direction. You know, almost like it's a trailer. And you know, this thing's good. I think it'll do well.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. You know, disproving the myth that people won't buy smaller trucks. In this country anymore. I really hope it does.
Yeah, well, and it's not, I mean...
But it's not that small. I would love to sit there and pull out all the specs because, I mean, it's... I mean, right now, obviously, with the long box, you know, it's a 3 or 4 point turn in a lot of narrow streets. Even pulling into a grocery store parking lot, you have to swing really wide. I mean, it's not Don't get the idea these are compact trucks. I mean, these are big trucks.
They're mid-sizers. They're probably the size of trucks historically, really.
They are. Yeah. The length on ours, the crew cab with the long box, a 6'2" box, is about 225 inches. That's pretty big.
That's long, yeah. That's like 58 Lincoln long.
And like I said, I mean, the biggest difference, I think, between a full-size truck and feel, you know, just maneuvering it dimensionally is width.
Yeah, and I mean that plays a big part though too, because I feel lost in a modern full size pickup. Like they're just they are relaxed fit.
This has got a really good backup camera though.
I think. Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got a dynamic nice lines
wide,
and all that.
Right, but and a nice crystal clear wide view, and that's helped.
So Chevy and GMC, they've done. It sounds like they've made a contender, and it sounds like they've done more than sort of like the easy thing to make a contender, because with trucks competition that's like 10 years old, it probably wouldn't be that hard to be the newest thing in the market, the newest and nicest thing. But it, in your estimation, have they gone kind of above and beyond with these trucks?
In my estimation, yeah. I mean, you're right. They could have come out with this truck a year or two ago. They had it in other markets, but it wasn't necessarily up to standards in terms of NVH and interior refinement, I think, were two key areas, and maybe even some of the driveline stuff. So I'm glad they took the extra time to bake it to this, level of consistency. I really think you have to be a brand loyalist. If you look at this product and you look at the Nissan and you look at the Toyota and you drive them both, I don't understand how you wouldn't arrive at this truck. I really don't. Unless there's just an absolute screaming deal and there's, $6,000 of difference between the two.
Or Ranger Splash is calling your name.
Well, as it is typically does, right?
I mean, fiberglass, flare side bed. I mean, it's just,
This is making me wonder if down the road we'll get flare sides back. I never understood flare sides, but
I just think they're ugly.
I do too.
They got extra curvature. What do you mean they're ugly?
And well, they've got to be aerodynamically inefficient. Also, so fuel economy, I almost got 398 miles out of one tank.
What is that, like a 25-gallon tank?
I think it's a 20 or 21-gallon tank. That's but it was about 21 miles per gallon. Not bad. Not bad at all.
It's not horrible.
It's a 21-gallon tank. That is correct.
And the one question I had is they've paid very, very careful attention to aerodynamics. And you walk out of the front of this thing, and it's got a pretty low splitter. I do wonder with the Z71 off-road package, the front approach angle is going to be pretty shallow.
And I've got to take a look at it. I know with the Silverado, they've got that sort of detachable with, four bolts or whatever it is, the rubber smile on the front. We had the new Mustang parked next to a Tahoe up against the parking barriers today. And we noticed that by appearances, it actually looked like the Tahoe was lower in the front than the Mustang was. It turns out that's actually not the case. There's a secondary sort of air dam that's below the front splitter that you can't see unless you get down real low on the Mustang. But they're actually not that far off. And it shows just how much they're stressing aerodynamics in these trucks and how they're willing to sacrifice arrival angles. It's just one of those things.
Well, I mean, the majority of people that buy those things, they don't off-road them where they need those approach and departure angles either.
So, right.
Like, maybe the folks who do actually take them off-road, tearing it off is it's a red badge of courage, as it were.
Sure. Well, and like I said, I mean, this one might unbolt. I'm going to have to take a look now that we mentioned it.
Yeah, and unbolt it and run the fuel economy test, because I'm sure you have all kinds of time to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, nothing but.
Yeah, it would be an interesting question. All right, so the Colorado, I guess my question is, like, does Ford follow this up with anything? And they're probably not going to anytime soon, but I'm sure they're watching.
Yes, they got to sit back and watch.
Yeah. So maybe everybody else wants that new Ranger. I'm not sure. I think the F-150 is probably where it's at for Ford. But
I guarantee you they won't bring the current Ranger, Global Ranger, over.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that.
That thing is so big, that's 7/8 scale. It would make no sense.
Yeah.
They'd have to come in with something significantly smaller. And I think it'd be interesting to see if, somebody wants to do something even smaller than this truck. There's been internet discussion of a Transit Connect pickup and how easy that would be to do. And I think that might be kind of interesting, although maybe kind of troublesome to look at. But I think there's more below this truck, because this is a pretty big truck.
I think it would be cool to have a Transit Connect-based pickup. I mean, front-wheel drive pickups have their place.
They used to.
Yeah. I mean,
they might again at some point. Who knows?
Who wouldn't rock a Rabbit pickup? So, I mean,
oh, come on.
You wouldn't.
Rabbit diesel pickup. That's what we're looking
right?
for.
Right? All
that's
of
what they all are, practically, is diesel.
55, unless you swapped the GTI motor into it.
That's what I want. The 16-valve GTI motor and the GTI look with the red line trim and, yeah.
Tartan seats. Hey, you know what? That is 20 minutes, and we mentioned the GTI. God damn it. All right, so moving fault. On. This week, what? I just stepped out of a 2015 Volvo S6, actually 2015 and a half Volvo S60 T5 Drive E.
All-wheel drive?
No, it's the front-wheel drive. So the T5 Drive E front-wheel drive has the new Drive E four-cylinder with the turbocharger on it.
And an 8-speed automatic, right?
Yeah, I had an auto with lots of speeds. I'm actually looking it up right now. But yeah, it's
yes
like,
is the answer.
I will say yes. These are great engines. The powertrains are really good, and the S60 feels good with them. I think they're better than the fives that they've had for a long time. The issues with the S60 continue to be the consistent issues with the S60, though, where it's kind of tight in the back seat and the trunk, and costs a lot compared to some of its competition.
Does it really, though?
Well, I mean, it was $37,000.
Yeah, no, that's not a lot.
I don't think that's a lot. I think that's in line.
That's not a lot at all.
Actually. Okay.
When you're looking at these Audi A3s now that are $37,000.
Right. I can make that argument for it. Like,
they're a lot smaller, mind you. With even smaller. Right.
Yeah. But I like the A3 a lot better than the S60.
Do you really?
Yeah.
I don't.
I haven't even driven the S60, and I probably like the S60 better because I think the A3 is too small.
I'd venture to say you would.
It was a very the S60 T5 is it's like that's the sweet spot for this car. It's really nice. It's comfortable. It's, you know, the materials are high quality. It's very quiet. It's very well built. It is a good car, but the issue is it doesn't quite reach that, and it's not priced like it either. So I mean, I guess I see your point there. Like, it doesn't quite reach that BMW, Audi, Mercedes echelon.
No, especially with options. I mean, it's more like Acura TSX, you know.
Yes.
Which is not around anymore. And it's, right. It's that. In fact, you know, had the wagon been available at the time, we might have bought that instead of our TSX Sport Wagon. I really like that car, especially with all-wheel drive.
But the TSX drives so much better.
No, I don't think so.
I do.
I don't.
I mean, the S60, like, the thing that I noticed about it that I wish were better was, you know, they've gotten... It's like a almost their car. You know, they've gotten the powertrains really refined and well done now, where I feel like this engine is on par with the BMW and the Audi four cylinders on that level. So, like, that's good. And I keep benchmarking those cars as the competitors, because they, you know, European premium brand. I don't know how accurate that is, because I really feel like the other car this competes with really directly is a Buick Regal. And I feel like the Regal does better. Although the Volvo is relentlessly upgrading their cars. Every year they're very attentively adding things to it. Like, this one had the new Sensus Sensus Connect.
Yeah, how is that? Because I haven't driven one with the Drive E or the Sensus yet.
Well, I mean, the thing is, like, it was like kind of like fancy tethering or like fancy Bluetooth. In that sense, which it's cool, but I think some of the extra features that sort of push you to the phone and the app on your phone, it's like, that's cool, but now you require an app on a phone. So you're cutting out the people who don't have that phone, don't have a compatible phone. Not that they're a huge base, and I understand that as a manufacturer, you need to kind of say, you know what, like, all you Windows Phone people, all 10 of you, like, you miss out. But it is like, it's an extra step, and I don't know whether I like it or not in that sense. Like, oh, I need to put an app on my phone to work with my car. But I do love the fact that they're counting on you having a device, because everybody does. And as a way to get more functionality out of the car, I think that's really smart, because it's a way where they don't have to actually put it into the car. You don't have to pay for, you know, a manufacturer to put in a device that's going to be obsolete, which is kind of like OnStar, right? OnStar is an embedded cellular phone with a whole bunch of other features, but
right.
At a certain point, that becomes obsolete, that hardware. Like, the original OnStar, that was analog cell network. Does it even work anymore? I don't know.
No, I believe my mom's got a Suburban with the original one, and she had to go in and have a module. Basically, the old guts ripped out and new guts put in.
Right. So
yeah.
That's, and did she have to pay for that?
Yeah, she had to pay for it.
Right.
Interesting that she did it.
So, I mean, that's costly for the automakers, and it sucks.
It was cheaper than a new Suburban.
That is true.
And that was my dad's motivation. Well, okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I like that the Pandora integration is obviously better, and you get stuff like TuneIn Radio, which is cool, because I really like every time my public radio station is fundraising to take TuneIn, put it into car mode, and get around the week and a half long fundraisers. You know, so it adds a bunch of functionality to the car that I think is really slick. And their infotainment system is still like Volvo-ish. So any way you can sort of expand that feature set and make it better, you're ahead of the game, because it's not the biggest screen in the business. It's okay. It's not the best interface in the business. It's okay. You know, and Volvo ergonomics, once you get used to them, are very good. So it's this car in a weird place, though. You know, like, it's got a small trunk, like a 12 cubic foot trunk or something. And the back's like, I would really love them to bring that S60L that they're doing for China over here, because that's been my consistent complaint from day one about the S60, is that the back seat is tight.
They might do it with the next generation. It wouldn't surprise me. I think there's starting to be more precedent for that sort of thing. You look at what Infiniti's doing. And you're probably right. They're probably missing out a little bit with the back seat on that, especially when people think of Volvos, they often think of families.
Right.
And that if you don't have the room there for anything beyond a, you know, car seat, it's kind of tough. I want to rewind for a second. I think you made a very smart comparison earlier that would have actually not occurred to me at first glance, when you mentioned that it probably lines up best against the Buick Regal.
Oh, and I feel like the Regal kills it in terms of driving dynamics.
See, and I have to drive them back to back. I had a Regal, you know, the all-wheel drive turbo, not the...
Right, not the GS or whatever.
Right, and I mean, it was a really nice car. The one I had was, I think, over 40 grand, and I wasn't really that blown away by it, to be perfectly honest. So I'd like to do these back to back, but I think you're right. I mean, obviously the Regal is a little bit bigger, so bigger trunk, bigger back seat, probably.
But in Southern California, a young family is going to go to the Volvo before they buy a Buick.
No, sure. I mean,
calling it from a Southern California perspective.
Right, and in Detroit, they'll go for the Buick.
And I think out here on the coast, on the East Coast, you may the Volvo will make an argument for itself too.
Sure,
but I think the Buick is the better vehicle in a vacuum.
I think you're right. Like, it's on paper they line up really, really well.
Yeah, but nobody's ever going to cross shop these two.
You should, but I think you're right too. You know, I think honestly the materials in the Volvo are a lot better. The refinement of the engine is a lot better. But the Regal,
that's a great little engine. I mean, if you look at that, 258 foot-pounds of torque. Audi's got, everybody has a 2-liter turbo right now. Audi's getting 220, 258. 220 horsepower, 210 horsepower, 258 foot-pounds. These guys are getting 240 horsepower and 258 foot-pounds of torque, and that's really good.
Yeah, no, and it doesn't feel winded. It's very good engine. It's smooth. It's not.
And 37 EPA.
Yeah,
that's crazy good.
I didn't get that, but I didn't get crappy mileage. And I, you know, being an S60 owner, like from the first generation, those cars never really did all that well. Like, they did okay, but this did better. It did very well in terms of fuel economy. And it drives well. It clips along. The ride kind of is where it falls apart, like the ride and handling balance. Like, it's a little bit harsh. It feels like it's not damped like it should be. It's a little stiff. And you know, again, like two cars before this, I had a 428, and that was just like insanely supple and also handled really well compared.
And
to
how much was that?
That was brushing up against 50. So
yeah.
I mean, there's that trade-off. The thing that I guess I scratch my head with the S60 because I'm like, it just like Buick, it's in between, right? It's not quite the high-end car. But it's not quite the sort of low-end car. But what separates this car from like a Fusion Titanium?
Like, I mean, I think the, you know, the aesthetic, I think the material inside is nicer. Yeah. I think
the materials on the Volvo are going to be much nicer than a Fusion. Yeah.
I mean, the build quality tech is still really good. And the safety tech, that's the other thing that this had. I shut it all off for the most part, but it has a whole bunch of stuff, a whole bunch of new stuff, you know, that...
I shut it all off.
Well, you know...
How cool is that?
I will say,
but it exists.
You're really gonna feel stupid when you run over the pedestrians.
I know. I'm gonna. No, I'm not. I'm gonna.
Well, it's sort of.
You should have been in the street. I was in Harvard Square today in Cambridge, and we call that the People's Republic of Cambridge. Man, pedestrians just jump right out in front of cars, like, "Oh, you're going to stop." It's like you might want to rethink that there. Yeah. Anyway, the I think the most impressive feature on the S60 is the way they've tuned the dynamic cruise control. It's fantastic. I was just saying,
you normally don't like that stuff at all, from what I remember.
No, because it's like jumpy and it's always like accelerate, brake. It's really, really well done. And
I love dynamic cruise control, and I've noticed it getting better and better. Better.
It is, because I'm getting to the point where I can tolerate it. Normally, I'm like, right. Dan.
Yeah, yeah. No, this was impressively good, and it works in a line of traffic where you just, you know, you just hit the button, and it'll follow the cars, and it's just, I was super impressed with that, because normally it sucks. So, I don't know. I mean, you guys have made a pretty good case for the S60. I'm kind of going, yeah, if I had 37K, I don't know that I'd spend it on the Volvo, but it is a... You know, it's a high quality car in a very tough place.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I just did a quick spec comparison also with the A4. And it compares very favorably with the A4 with the 2-liter. The A4 is a little bit bigger, but it's also significantly slower to 60.
And older.
Yep. And it's the S60 is lighter. It has comparable rear seat and trunk room. In fact, it has more passenger volume.
S60 will have better crash test scores too, just because that B8 platform is older.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I
like the A4, but I think the S60 all-wheel drive, the T5, is a really fantastic car.
I think it really is the sweet spot, especially when you pair it with all-wheel drive, which they haven't done with this new engine. I think that if you get the all-wheel drive, you still get the light pressure turbo 5-cylinder, which isn't bad, but it's not as refined as the new engine. So I'm impressed with that, because it's a 4-cylinder, and you know, you go to 4-cylinders, you get the rocking couple and all the buzziness and all that stuff. So, you know, it's a good car. It's just... I don't know. You really owe it to yourself to shop really hardcore in that segment and see what you can get and see what you like, because it really is, you know, it's hard when you're spending over $35,000 to buy something that's terrible, but you got to find something that sort of like fits with your needs and your likes, and being a family with young kids, this car might be difficult, but you might gravitate towards it because of the safety part of it, but you're going to find that, like, I had to take my strollers apart to put them in the trunk. And that aggravated me to no end. Yeah. It, because kids' stuff is big now, too. So if you have a lot of money, you can buy all the mini European kid stuff, like rock and roll.
Get the V60.
The V60 solves a lot of those issues, too. And it's going to drive pretty much the same.
The same. And it'll look cooler.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's open for debate. Some people like wagons. If it's in brown with a manual and a diesel, yeah, sure. All right. So we'll go back. Let's go back to trucks, actually, because Mike, you managed to snag. We didn't talk about this last week. It's been a couple of weeks, but last week was the epic episode 400. So you were in the 2015 F-150. And you got to.
I managed to snag it. That's an interesting way.
Well, I mean, you managed to snag some seat time in it, and everybody's pretty curious about it. It's got those Atlas show truck cues, but you know, is it same as it ever was, or is it, you know, hugely improved? What's the scoop?
Yeah, it's first of all, up front, and I mentioned this in the story, is that you know, Ford was pushing a lot of people through this program. And it was rather rushed. I mean, I think my feet were on the ground less than 24 hours, and I never had a morning or an evening really with the truck. Engineers in the truck the whole time, so when every time I try to push it, I'd get, "Whoa, this isn't a sports car." And but you know, the big news, obviously, I mean, I'm serious. One guy says, "Excuse me, Mr. Harley, this is not a Lamborghini," you know, or something. And I turn around and I'm like, "You know, we're in Texas. The road goes 400 miles." You know, never mind. So,
did you swear at him? Did you?
I smiled. Come on, I'm polite. I don't need to be shown my ticket in the airport. I mean, you know, I'd like to drive the truck. And you know, the big news is a reinforced, stronger, high strength steel frame and an aluminum body. So everything, the bed, the walls, the doors, the hood, is all aluminum. And you know, it makes a big difference because it is lighter. And we were all accusing, you know, Ford at this launch, we expected to have, you know, here's the fuel economy, here's how much every model is lighter than its predecessor. But they're still holding a lot of stuff quiet.
Well, they did release fuel economy numbers. Like, we updated the post with that. They
yeah, so we've got a few things. But the bottom line is, does it drive better? Is it a better truck? It is a better truck. It's got a ton of, hey, let's talk mechanically. Suspension is more or less carried over. Engines, there's a new 2.7 engine that's wonderful. I actually like it. I would definitely take it over the naturally aspirated engines, but they also told the naturally aspirated engines, like the V8, are going to be the fleet, you know, industrial heavy worker guys. But you know, it drives better, better payload, better towing, all these things that you know, you'd expect if you could take weight off the truck. You know, is it going to matter to the customer? Who knows? I also think it rides a little rougher than the previous models. And if you really think about the fact that now the springs have to carry, you know, 4,000 pounds instead of carrying 3,500 pounds, they are going to be a little tighter. And it may be a little bumpier. But then we went back and asked Ford, and they had a really interesting quote, and I believe I put that in the story, is that we will not take the truck out of the truck. And something that maybe they're going to accuse Ram, you know, with his air suspension and things like that. And Chris will probably say, you know, a lot of these trucks are – everybody's trying to make their truck ride like a crossover.
Yeah. And, go ahead. Not to interrupt, but you mentioned the air suspended Ram. I actually had the opportunity to drive an F-150 and a Ram unchaperoned back to back today on the same roads, and I made a point of driving them at the exact same speeds through the same section of roads, including some very, very buckled pavement, sort of, you know, hot patch holding hands, not really a road. And right. I have to say, I was shocked. The F-150 was significantly better in terms of ride quality and NVH than the air suspended Ram. Now,
wow.
Yeah, and not even, honestly, not even by a little bit. It was actually significantly better. And I liked the Ram a lot. And the one I drove was the diesel, so obviously NVH, you know, that as far as the stuff that the powertrain is providing, it's going to be louder. It just is. But the ride quality was better.
Well, I mean, that's not terribly surprising, though, when you consider that the F-150 is significantly lighter, too, right?
Yeah, but also, I would also say the F-150 is probably significantly stiffer. I mean, you're bonding, you're riveting every one of those panels. You're not going to squeak and rattle. I mean, it is a hell of a tight chassis and a hell of a tight platform. You know, that's surprising because I also had the Ram diesel for a week, and I loved its ride. But, once again, I didn't have them back-to-back.
Yeah.
I guess the thing for me with the F-150 is
Which engine, Chris?
I drove both the 2.7 and the 3.5.
So which thing of the 2.7?
I was shocked at how good the 2.7 is.
Yeah, I really like the 2.7. The 3.5 is a burly little engine.
Yeah, and I think, you know, honestly, I think most people would probably be perfectly happy with the 2.7. What I want to know about that, and in fact about both of the engines really, is what real-world fuel economy is going to be like, because I've often found, we've talked about this ad nauseum, but that you don't actually get EPA numbers or anywhere near them with Ford EcoBoost stuff and most small turbo stuff. And I'm wondering if in dropping to the 2.7, you're going to be in the boost more often.
Yeah, you're going to be. And I mean, I would argue that if you've got a 100-mile commute on your ranch every day, go with the 2.7. But if you're zipping on and off the turbo, you may get better fuel economy with the 3.5 because you're going to use its torque.
Yeah. The 3.5 naturally aspirated or the 3.5
turbo? No, the 3.5 turbo. Because, you know, the turbocharged engines are wonderful as long as you're out of the boost. But the second you get in the boost, your mileage drops down to single digits.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't care if you're in an Audi, you know, 2.0 turbo. I mean, you're going up a hill, you're at 9 miles per gallon.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, that's been turbo's thing for,
right.
Yeah, for decades. It's, you know, it's a variable compression engine. So,
right. But what Chris and I are saying is that, you know, the 2.7 is going to work a lot harder around town, even though it's going to look up on paper as the more fuel efficient engine, just because when it's on the highway, it'll be more efficient.
I could actually see that happening, in part because I think you get used to the power.
That's true.
And having that you're more inclined to dip your toe in it and get up to speed quickly. I you know, had the old school version of this issue back in college. I had a Ranger with the 3-liter, the Vulcan V6. And there was also, if you guys remember, the normally aspirated 2.3 and a 4-liter V6. And the 4-liter, I think, in reality, probably got better fuel economy than the 3 because you were always pushing the 3 all the time.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that they can do now with modern turbos is they can much more tightly control the wastegate. You know, it's all, like, electronically controlled. So it's not like the old analog turbos where your city mileage was crap. So, I mean, I think yes to a point. Your fuel economy may suffer in town with the 2.7, but I think it's also a decent truck and a decent powertrain for somebody who's like sort of the occasional truck user where they want a truck and they don't necessarily make it work every day. You know?
Oh yeah, and you don't even need the 2.7 for that. Honestly, you could just do with the, you know, the base normally aspirated V6. This is a lot of truck, and of course the pricing gets up there too. One of the things that I noticed is I drove both the 4-door and the extended cab, and granted the versions we drove were pre-production, but the extended cab had real trouble with door closure. And other journalists mentioned this as well. It just wouldn't close consistently. You had to sit there and slam it a few times, and the fitment wasn't that great. So
the door that opens 180 degrees?
This was me slamming the front door with the back door closed.
Yeah, but which doors were they? They were the old clamshell doors.
Yes, yes,
right. I hate those. That's one of my biggest complaints about the F-150. Even now. Is just
that's those, why they offer the 4-door.
I know, and the 4-door cleans up a lot of that. It's just those clamshell doors; they never feel solid. The cab never feels solid because there's always that flex where the B pillar should be. You know, it's just a little bit, and it's reinforced.
I bet
this
is a fitment thing because I'm a big believer in this whole new aluminum architecture.
No, I agree with you, Mike. I think it's going to be really stiff. Like it's bonded and riveted with. You know, a lot more rigidity than a spot welded steel cab. You know, you've got, if you're bonding it, you've got much longer seams of it, you know, structural adhesive. It's built like a supercar at that point. It's, you know, it's a lot more rigid, a lot stiffer. So it's probably just a pre-production thing. I would expect that they're going to get that right for production or they're going to be very unhappy.
Also, Chris, at the launch, every truck was there that was pre-production. It's going to get crushed. It's going to meet its demise. They were telling us that. So,
Or you can get them for a dollar, right, and run them in lemons?
They'll be recycled into cans.
It's a different alloy, though, right? You made that point. It's not. It's
well,
not
there's a whole bunch different, of different alloys different, in this thing.
Yeah, it's right. A different type of alloy. But I think it's cool. I'm excited about it. You know what? A bunch of people think it's really, really going to change the whole full-size truck. But the truth is it's like the 787 jet that Boeing came out with. You know, it's a carbon fiber fuselage. It has a couple of advantages. But it doesn't really change the way you get on a jet and go from point A to point B. It, you know, it still takes just as much time and things like that. And aluminum doesn't revolutionize the whole full-size truck industry, but it does things better. And
it does something.
I do think we're going to see more and more trucks utilize more and more aluminum. It'll be really cool to see 20 years down the road, you know, how the beds are holding up without the corrosion issues and things
like
that.
Well, let's see that. Okay, so, I'm going to call BS on that because everybody says it doesn't rust. It certainly doesn't rust like metal, but it will corrode.
Yeah, it corrodes. It's salt's going to eat the stuff like
it corrodes
crazy.
Like a bastard, especially right. If you've got things like and on trucks, people love to do this. They love to put accessories on. You're going to have to be very careful about the
when
bolts you use.
Them, right? When you start putting seal bolts through the aluminum. And,
right. You'll discover where the ions go in the galvanic reactions.
Issue is – I mean, I went out of my way in my story not to say it's corrosion. It's more corrosion resistant to different materials. I mean, it's waterproof, but you're right. You have a whole bunch of other issues.
I mean,
and repairs too.
Yeah, but I mean,
Joe at the body shop down the corner with a tub of Bondo is not going to be able to fix it.
No,
but here's
and that's
the thing.
Why they've had to invest in dealer retraining and new tools and all of that.
Right,
and that's going to be a real test. They went around to the insurance companies and talked to them. And they say they've got all this stuff figured out, but we won't know for a little while until people start crashing these things, you know, and how happy they are really with their experience.
But Chris, now that you said that, this car is loaded with some cool electronics. I mean, from the LED lights to the, I think it even has radar-based cruise control, doesn't it?
But it's possible.
They
it
offer
does.
A bunch of stuff that you've never. Ever see, you know, 360 cameras in a pickup truck?
Yeah, and that's a very great,
a bunch
that's
of
a great
cool technology.
Cowboy Cadillac, man.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. And I mean, you know, I think that what you're going to see too is Ford, I think this is a very smart play by Ford to actually go to aluminum production on a vehicle with this volume because you know they're going to sell a whole bunch of them. You know, it's right. Like they're guaranteed to sell. It's very difficult to take a car that moves 35,000, 40,000 units and make that scale. So it's probably easier to start big and then bring it down to the vehicle market or the sedan market versus the truck market.
Yeah,
so.
They're having to pull their suppliers up kicking and screaming to supply this kind of volume. The industry, you know, wasn't ready for this a year ago. And they've had to go around and talk to a lot of people and see what they can get out of it. And I think there's a lot more conversation around that. They're going to do their full-size trucks this way. I bet the next Expedition and Navigator will be that way. And, you know, I think the competitors are going to be in relatively short order.
Yeah. And you know what? The industry was never going to be ready for it until somebody decided to do it.
Yep.
You know, like they're not going to just wait around and develop it. You know, that you have to just, you know, at a certain point pull the trigger. So, I mean, kudos to Ford for that. And, you know, how's the interior on it? Like one of my bigger complaints about the F-150 is it just feels so antique. It's a good truck. They're all good trucks. Every
interior is all new.
But
interior is nice.
Is it like nice or is
I mean,
it sort
but
of
it
like,
even looks new. I mean, you know, for years we've had the round dials as the HVAC vents have been round.
Right.
And, you know, it's completely new. It looks nice. At least the one I rode in it was nice. But I also drove in the Platinum model. I spent most of my time in the Platinum
model. Oh, well, I mean, yeah. And so it better be nice.
Well, I drove the Platinum as well as the lesser model, and they are nice. I think stylistically I still prefer the Ram, both exterior and you know, some of the interior models. Even I'm not really like a, you know, the cowboy type, but if I'm going to get a full size truck,
oh, come on,
truck,
Chris. Take those boots
if I'm going to get a full size truck, man, I want those belt buckles, you know? and I'll be looking for the King Ranch when it comes out because I've always had a soft spot for the King Ranch. I can't explain, but if you're going to go, you know, full cowboy.
Yeah, man.
Get your big boots on.
I support the go big or go home thing. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think this...
I like the looks of the Ram as well, too.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much if you're looking for a pickup, throw a rock, you're going to hit one that's good, so...
Yeah, they're all pretty good.
But the points you make about the F-150 are actually pretty significant. You know, it's not just, you know, using aluminum on the body and all of a sudden, woohoo, we're good. Like, every component can then be optimized, can be a little lighter, you know, a little different, not quite as heavy duty, even down to the brakes, you know, where you get the similar performance out. You know, consider brakes, they're hunks of iron. So if you can take some of that weight out, you're doing well.
And they're talking about like 700-pound weight loss in some terms, something like that. Yeah,
so that's that makes huge.
It is huge, and I think it's important to remember that the F-150 was a heavy truck before, so it's probably what, like a 400 or 500-pound difference between this and competitor models now. Right. But that's still you know, that's a couple of full size Americans.
Diabetes.
What are you saying? All right, wait a second.
All right, let's shift gears. There's a new Ferrari, just for us, and it's, you can't have one, but it's cool. And I figured, because Mike, you and Chris, like, you guys always get the high end stuff. You have a particular.
Mike is going to get this before I will. Let's be clear here.
You both have a particular appreciation for high end.
They're only selling much. 10 of them, 20 of them.
10 of them. 10 of them.
No, yeah. Nobody's getting. In fact, by saying I don't think these are collectibles. You know, it's not faster. It's not a performance upgrade. This is not a special model or a Scuderia or anything. This is a collector model.
I love that they came out with one and it's not Rosso Corsa. It's the
interior just about is.
Well, yeah, but that's okay. I mean, it's such a fashion item. Like, oh, well, the driver's side of the cockpit is red and the passenger side of the cockpit is black. Yes. It's a Barbie doll for very rich people.
Yeah, the interior reminds me of like those crazy like $50,000 Nautilus speakers, you know?
Yes, totally. Especially down with the shifter buttons.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's beautiful. It's cool. It's damn fast. It's damn exclusive. It's everything a Ferrari should be.
Front engine V12. No. Gotcha.
and more than a Veyron, right?
Yeah. It's, how much is it? 2 million?
I think it was rumored at 2.5.
It doesn't matter. It was 2.5, but you can't have one.
Oh, it's 2.5. Yes.
2.5.
Yeah. Is that all?
Yeah. I mean, I do honestly, like, and I'm not an open top car kind of guy, but I think that the looks at the, because based on the F12 Berlinetta, it improved.
The F12 was badass. But it was not a sports car like Chris and I are going to go zooming through the canyons in. It was just I can kick anyone's ass. And
it's a GT. You know, it's a classic front engine V12 Ferrari GT, which I think is, you know, I mean, like, that for me, that's the sweet spot. I don't know. Maybe I'm just, you know, a 60-year-old rich dude inside. I wish I were.
730 horsepower.
Right.
That's just.
I mean, it's fast. It's quick, right?
Of course, it's 63.1
seconds. I'm sure it's both.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. I was doing that for your benefit.
Sure, it's both.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's no question about that. It's fast.
Yeah, it's.
Can you get it in any other color? Or does it only come in blue?
No, they're all in art livery.
Yeah. I wonder if they'll turn around and they'll make another 10 in a hard top.
Oh, like Lamborghini did?
Like everybody always does with these cars.
Yeah, Lamborghini, you know, had their Veninos. They were only going to make 3, and they're just like, oh, shit, we sold these pretty quickly. We're going to make a different version. You're right.
Right. Well, when you get
to... Someone's going to say, wait, it's $2.5 million and it has a canvas top? Or a light fabric top?
It has a light fabric top that's good for, 120 kilometers per hour? So that's like 70
miles. Usable. Yeah, 170. Or it's only good for 75 miles an hour, which is, let's see, one-third of the top speed, maybe?
So what happens if you exceed 120 miles?
Rearview mirror, and you'll see your light fabric top. Like,
right off the top.
That's like the, Erector set LP640 Roadster top that I had a couple of years ago.
Oh, I bet it is.
Where it's, you know, it's an actual like test of your mental acuity to see if you can fit it all together.
Well, and the LP640, like, that was probably designed by Germans too. Like, where this is probably like a purest Italian inscrutability. to try to figure it out.
Yeah, I suspect that they probably won't put that top on very much.
No.
No.
I mean, it's a car that's going to live in a climate-controlled garage. And
then get rolled out onto the lawn at Pebble in 50 years.
Exactly. I think that, and
for,
I think that was
$10 million.
Yeah, I think that was the point that Jonathan Ramsey made when he attended the – I mean, think about where they unveiled this car too. Beverly Hills, like City Hall or whatever, right?
Rodeo Drive, yeah.
Yeah. He made the point that we're looking at the future of Pebble Beach in 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, I totally think so. And if they make a coupe version, the people that bought the convertible version are going to buy that one too.
But isn't that kind of a shame? Like, that's, I think, where I have that disconnect. Like, I want to drive the thing. And I mean, I'm sure I could drive a lesser Ferrari, if there is such a thing, and have plenty of thrills. But why would you build a car that's, you know, is going to get stored? Well, I guess Ferrari doesn't care. They just want to build and sell them. But it's just a weird thing when you get into that, like, collector.
Well, yeah, I mean, at that end of the market, everything's sort of ridiculous and silly to begin with, right? I mean, if you're just dealing with levels of absurd. So,
drive an F12. It'll drive exactly the same.
No, I know, but then why make 10 cars you know are destined to never be driven?
Because you can make $2.5 million.
Yes, and Autobahn just talked about it. The world's talking about it.
Yep.
That's why.
And because it can show their flexibility and their ability to build small volume cars and to do custom commissions, like the Glickenhaus stuff. There's totally a reason to do this car.
And Lamborghini and McLaren and all those, and all the guys are sitting there going, how are we going to get in the news next week?
You know how they can get in the news? They can send me one with winter tires, and we'll long-term test.
That'll be a lot of news.
Yeah,
I was going to say, that might be the wrong kind of news.
I'm a very,
hey, you know what?
If we back up real quick,
you know, another interesting move with Ford switching over to aluminum, I bet they get an awful lot of people going in the showrooms for test drives.
Probably.
I mean, just want to see what because it's, about, it's right? One of those, hey, this isn't just, this is all new plus. Just back, and that's one thing I always fail to mention is, you know, that is a really good, cool move. Marketing-wise, hey, you know, I've driven the F-150s. I've driven, the, you know, since 1927. But you know what? This is an all-new one. I'm going to go check it out.
Well, and the funny thing about that is I bet you the marketing isn't going to talk about the aluminum much.
Right.
They're probably not going to talk about it at all because the full-size pickup truck market has been pretty, you know, conservative historically.
Right.
About
they don't
innovation.
Like new. They don't like new.
Although Ram is capitalizing on, you know, they found a niche with stuff like air suspension and independent, but coil spring rear suspensions and all of that. So maybe there's less of a culture of that now than there was, say, 15 or 20 years ago. But I bet you they won't be talking about it in their ads. And we haven't seen the first commercials that have come out as a result of this truck yet. But I suspect they'll be pretty quiet about the A word.
They may be. I mean, they may talk about it in terms of efficiency versus like directly saying aluminum. Because
right,
I mean,
they'll just point to the fuel economy numbers right. And say, "Look,
right."
That's all they're going to do.
But that's, I mean, in terms of advertising, that's what you do anyway. It's just sort of, you know, you set up problem solution, right? Like. Problem, trucks get crappy mileage. Solution, the aluminum F-150 gets better mileage. So I can see that you can be oblique about it and not freak out your core customers who you know, they buy millions and millions of those things every year, and you don't want to alienate those people. So
yeah. Well, I think word is out there to some extent already, not just among the enthusiast community, because we've been talking about it. The fleet people will obviously take a very close look at this thing, but I had a conversation today, you know, like I said, I just drove this truck, and our home base actually for our testing is a motorcycle club, like a Hell's Angels sort of light, you know, motorcycle club, clubhouse.
In hell.
Absolutely. Awesome. So I was talking to the member that was there and, you know, a really nice guy, and he already knew that it was aluminum and was asking me about how all that stuff works out.
Yeah, I think there's going to be interest, and anything you do, you're, you know, you're tip of the spear. It's a plus for you. So
He was more freaked out by the fact that it had a 2.7-liter engine.
What's the matter with that? Didn't the Model T have like a 2.7-liter?
It's small, and he wanted to know about durability on the turbos and everything.
I mean, you've had turbocharged cars. Have you ever replaced a turbo?
In the 80s, you did. These days, you don't.
No,
these days, they're super reliable.
I have never had any issues.
And the put only it time this way, the way automakers have to warranty them today, there's no way they're going to throw turbos if they're going to burn out in 30 or 40,000 miles.
Yeah, and I mean, ever since really they switched to water-cooled turbos, like back the original turbos were all oil-cooled and they were hard on the oil. And
post-coolers where the oil continues to circulate and the water circulates after you shut the engine.
Yeah, a little turbo timer, ever since they switched to water-cooled cartridges, like they've been fine. The only time I've ever replaced a turbo has been for a performance upgrade. And that turns out to actually be sort of a misnomer because usually you put the bigger turbo on and your performance sucks until you're at full boost. And then, yeah. Anyway, we talked about the Ferrari that does 0 to 60 in 3.1 seconds. The other thing we saw over the last couple of weeks was another car that does 0 to 60 in 3.2 seconds. And I don't know that they're going to actually make any money off this one either, because I don't think they've managed to make their company make a whole lot of actual money, but they certainly made a lot of goodwill and a lot of press. Tesla unveiled the Model S D-Trim with a bunch of other technology, but I guess the biggest sort of high points are it's all-wheel drive now, it's ridiculously quick. If you switch it to, I think Elon was saying in his unveiling that it's going to actually say insane, which I don't believe until I see it.
I feel it will.
I bet they will.
So that probably
seems like something they would do.
And especially considering how many people are going to tweet it, and you know, that's more publicity.
Right. And so the performance is one thing, but the other thing that it debuted is, I think it's the first car with autopilot, like on sale, right? Like actual autopilot.
Well, I mean, what's the definition of autopilot? Right,
and it's not technically legal to have autopilot.
Well,
yet.
Okay, so it has the hardware for autopilot, and obviously it'll do those automated cruise control things. But yeah, when it's on private property, which we'll know, this is all from his unveiling speech. So how much of this is like reality versus like, well, we'd like to do this eventually, is up for debate. But you know, when it's on private property, which it'll know because it's got GPS in it, obviously, you can basically send it to the garage for the night. Like, sit, Ubu, sit. And it'll go, it'll open the garage door with its integrated opener, and it'll park itself in the garage, and off you go. And I mean, that's pretty cool. You can send the car to bed.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how that actually works out. I know we've been working toward that. And I wonder what happens like when you send it to park in the garage and Junior
runs over a kid.
Yeah, Junior has left his tricycle out. What happens then? Does it just like sit half in and out of the garage? Does it come back to you? Or does it run over Junior?
You know, I think Ma and Pa run over Junior a lot more than the actual car.
I firmly believe that we have solved a lot of the technology on autonomous, but I don't think we've solved the legal issues on autonomous.
I don't think, yeah. I think that anytime anything bad happens with one of these things, instead of going, oh, you're an early adopter, you know, because back you're in the day, murderer. Right? Like, well, I mean, when cars first came out, how many people broke their arms with the before they had electric starters? You know, that was sort of like one of the hazards of an automobile. If that were to happen now, you'd have lawsuits out the wazoo. People would be suing, you know, General Motors and Ford, like, oh, you know, I cranked it over wrong and it broke my forearm. Like, so we're in a different place where they have to think about that liability, which kind of sucks. But I don't think that it'll run over Junior. I think that it'll just stop. You can detect.
So what happens when it does that? Does it just like leave the car half in and out of half out of the garage, or does it back up and come back to you, or does it, you know, flash a warning on your cell phone and you've got to come out from your dinner, or what?
Right. What I would say like the smart thing would be to make it call you, and you know, there's a lot of ways to at least sort of band-aid that problem first. Mm. If not absolutely.
And I'm not saying they haven't figured that out. I'm just curious to see how it actually behaves in those circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just think it's like, it's getting there, you know? And that's one of the things, like, you know, Tesla, they've made a lot of noise and they've pushed a lot of technology. They've been around a while, and a lot of their early competitors have completely disappeared. They've managed to have staying power. How much do you guys think that they're actually pushing the big guns along to adopt some of this stuff or develop some of this stuff on their own too? They've been pretty innovative thinkers. Maybe you think that's sort of trickling up?
I mean, you know, other automakers who are usually loath to acknowledge the competition have said, you know, they're watching them very closely. GM has apparently created a whole group of people just to follow their innovation and tear apart their cars and try and learn to think more like Tesla. And I bet you they're not the only ones. As you alluded to, I don't think Tesla's making any money on these cars yet. But no doubt they're studying everything from the way they approach vehicle design and electric powertrains to marketing, and obviously the dealer issue and all of that. So I think they're a fascinating, disruptive force in the industry. I think we've talked about this before. I would have never expected them to still be around if you'd asked me about it pre-Model S. To last this long. I thought they would have gone the way of something like Fisker, but I'm really impressed.
Yeah. What is the what's the range on this the D model?
I don't know if they've released it or not yet.
The one thing
frustrates me is I get why they've gone all-wheel drive, and I get why they've got, you know, first of all, they're not the first. I mean, when Elon came out, he says, wow, look at this. We have two completely separate powertrains. They're not the first company to do that. The NSX is also going to have motors up front. The Porsche 918 has electric motors up front that are independent.
You can arguably not buy an NSX yet. You can buy a 918.
You can buy a 918, correct.
But my point is,
I would be more impressed with Tesla if they come out with a car that has a 500 or 600 mile electric range versus one that does 0 to 60 in 3.2 seconds.
Well, I mean,
I think that's what the industry really needs.
I think it's a lot easier to make
more battery innovation.
We need more range.
I think it's a lot easier to make an electric car accelerate very quickly. I think that's almost a parlor trick. Right. Like, that's just the nature of the beast. It's got all its torque all at once, no waiting. So the acceleration is not a huge deal to make happen. That range, that's the big problem. That's the battery technology, and they're going to need to stick around, and there's no easy solution for that because you're dealing with sort of, you know, chemistry and production and, you know, like lots of interlocking problems that need to be solved. I'm sure they could make a 500 mile range battery, but it would be some very expensive exotic technology prone to catching on fire.
Right, but there's also a thing that, you know, a lot of people who are not familiar with the industry will see that 3.2 and say, "Wow, look how fast it is." I still have yet to see. I've heard rumors that a Model S was run around Laguna Seca and couldn't even complete the full lap without going into some sort of limp mode.
I've heard that from, I think, the publication that did it, and they did it a number of times.
Yeah, you and I are talking about the same place then. And,
yeah.
It's cool that Tesla can pull out these facts and figures, but it's not like, you know, this isn't an M5 competitor. This isn't an S5, RS7 competitor.
Well, but it is from a sales perspective.
Yeah, I mean, and I have to give them credit. And like Chris says, 5 years ago, there was no way I would believe that these guys. I mean, in Southern California, you see these things all over the place.
Yeah, they're like the Camry of Silicon Valley. But that's.
But it's a good car too.
No, it's a good car, but also it's a premium product for people who want to conspicuously green themselves. You know, it's the iPhone of cars, for crying out loud. Like, that has merit when you're trying to turn a profit, right? You create a demand.
And but there's no NACTOY competitor this year from Tesla, right?
No. And in fact, the Model S wasn't a competitor because they wouldn't give us one.
Well, they don't need you.
They
don't want to run over those roads where the Ram ran over.
that's partially true, too. But they're not a company that deals with the media outlets in traditional ways, especially in terms of automotive press. They don't oblige test drives as much. They're not going to be handing out long-term cars and right. and all of that. And frankly, they don't really need to. So they're still getting all the press. They're still getting all the publicity. They have all that goodwill. And frankly, long-term tests might not be in their favor at this point.
No, and you see
look at what happened with Consumer Reports, right?
Right. Well, and you see the same kind of thing, like in that sense, from companies like Ferrari. Ferrari doesn't need us. They do and they don't, but they very carefully control the message and the story, and that's exactly what Tesla's doing. And they're putting their cars out there in places where they generally will be shown in their best light. So yeah, a long-term test is not going to happen unless you buy one. No. At this point. And they don't need to lend the car out for a long-term test. They can sell it that they make.
That's so, right. There's no incentive to do that.
Right. And they're getting tremendous buzz out of us because we're talking about it right now. So take a note, take lessons from this in terms of like launching a product. This is how you do it. You control the message. You point out all of its positives. You turn some of its negatives into positives, and you don't talk about the stuff that are truly negatives.
Well, and I think, the other thing is that when they've had really negative problems, like some of the fires, they've gone above and beyond in a way that I think a traditional automaker never would. They've quickly executed a fix. They've gone and, before anyone has called for any recalls, even if it hasn't been necessarily a problem, that would have been a recallable action, getting pressure from the government to do it. They've gone and fixed it, and then they've gone and upgraded all the other cars, and they've explained it to the owners. And I think they've created this interesting culture where even though these owners are reporting quite a few problems, a lot of little electronic niggles and whatnot, they've got this sort of beta tester environment, and they're, maybe that's easier with a vehicle like this that's for early adopters and technophiles and whatnot, where people are willing to tolerate that as long as they're part of the process.
Yeah, and I think honestly I would be willing to tolerate that as long as I was part of the process and I could have the sort of direct line to a fix and stuff.
But it's amazing how tall. I don't expect the first F-150 aluminum truck owners to say, well, we're early adopters to aluminum. We're going to,
guys. No, not that truck. No.
No, but
these
I think.
These guys are drinking the Kool-Aid, bathing in the Kool-Aid, showering in it, and their skin's red. These guys are devout.
I think that you're going to find, though, the first year F-150s are going to be different, and they're going to have issues that they solve within the first year. Are those early problems and people are going to have to deal with it and put up with it. Like, I think you're going to see that. They're really amplified when you're creating a kind of car that hasn't existed before. Mm-hmm. There's going to be enough issues switching from one material to another for the majority of your body. To think about switching from one propulsion system to another, developing the software to control and charge and, stuff that just hasn't been done before. So they've done a tremendous job. I really want the Model X to get here. And I thought, through all the buildup, that's what this was.
So
was, we're going to release the Model X. We're going to release the Model X. And I was like, it's just a faster Model S. I mean, that's cool, yeah. But it's not the Model X. It's not the lower priced volume model in that market niche that's really going to have potential to move the needle.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say this was an easy mod to add a couple electric motors and software.
Yeah. Look at all the press they got from it, even if it was a little bit of a disappointment, at least to the enthusiast press. It still, gives them mind share. It shows that they're moving the product forward, which they continue to do. They're updating that product on what seems like a weekly basis. They're doing a lot of running changes. And I think that's really impressive, and I think that's just a different sort of culture. But I don't think we're going to see that affordable car before they have, the Model X in production and they show that car. I just think they've got to get their cadence right. And so to expect to see it, the last couple of weeks forget it.
Yeah, well, so for all that it's awesome and it has, you know, autopilot and stuff, I'm still disappointed that it's not, you know, it's not something that I stand a little bit more of a chance of affording.
It's all about you, Dan, really.
Absolutely it is. I mean, look, I only answer to one guy, me. all right, so we'll hit the Q&A now, I think, because we're at an hour 12, hour 15, so I think it's a good time to hit some questions, and we had a very amusing one right off the top, where Tom in California asked, is it just me, or is the Lexus NX the new Pontiac Aztec?
The answer is no, it is not. I just drove that car over the last couple of days. I don't particularly care for it, to be perfectly honest with you, but it will sell. I think it is incredibly unattractive visually.
Yeah, which is, I mean, I think that's the Aztec.
Yeah, but the Aztec didn't sell. And so that's why it's the butt of jokes. This thing you're probably going to see a lot. So if you're just judging it on appearances, I think it's really unfortunate looking, particularly in the standard model. In the U.S. trim, where the nose is sort of pointy so that they could get it classified as a truck. It's really horrible to look at. I'm sorry. It's just terrible.
Yeah, but see, here's the difference, too.
But like, I thought the Cherokee was the same way when I first looked at it.
Yeah, but okay, so the Cherokee is in a niche. It's got a name behind it, which is, I think, the things that are going to make the Lexus sell. Yeah,
I also think Lexus people, I don't want to say blind, but there is a following with whatever Lexus makes, they're going to sell. I mean, within reason. You're right.
Yeah.
Failures.
And it's also, it's probably not likely to be a flaming pile of crap like the Aztec was. The Aztec was like a bad show car idea.
Plus.
Like, I mean, it was
a mediocre minivan.
Right. Plus a mediocre minivan. Plus like some vehicle line engineer's checklist. And they were all like, there's a lot of people that were very proud of what the program achieved. That's cool. They put out a piece of crap that met all its objectives. Great.
Well, and let's also remember that America's idea of what a crossover should be didn't exist yet, right? So they were sort of hitting a target that wasn't there or looking for that.
Right. It was the germ of the idea, but it just was executed poorly.
Yeah, germ is the correct term. Yeah, but the NX will sell because it's a crossover, because it's a Lexus, because it's fairly refined. But it's really ugly, and I don't actually think it's that great of a vehicle, to be perfectly honest with you.
All right. Well, I don't think it's the Aztec. I think it'll be a lot more successful. So let's stay in this sort of crossover tip, though. CRV was recently named SUV of the year. What's your take on this? What would you have chosen instead? So I think Randy in Illinois is upset that the CRV was chosen, where I think that's probably a solid choice, actually, given what I know about crossovers and that size range. I think it's probably a vehicle that does everything well. Feel free to disagree with me.
CRV is very, very good. My favorite in that segment is the CX-5. But
yeah.
I could see why the CRV is a better sell to a family. It's roomier. It's got some cool trick features that make it more user-friendly. But I still like the driving dynamics of the CX-5.
Yeah, I'll agree with all that. I think you, by Jove, you're right, Mike.
But you could recommend either of those cars, and your best friend's not going to call you and complain the next morning. I mean, either of those. I mean, they're really good. And the CRV is a really, really good car.
And it'll have good resale value, and you'll probably have a decent dealer experience.
And it's it's one of those things that we talked about this over and over again. You know, you put a Honda in your driveway, and your neighbors glance over and they go, they bought a Honda, and they walk in their front door. You put a Mazda in your driveway, and there are still people that are going to look over and go, hey, John, why'd you buy the Mazda? It's a no-brainer, and it's a really, really solid decision. So,
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I mean, I like the way the Mazda drives, but the CR-V is probably going to please a wider swath of people. And
also, was the CR-V is refreshed for 2015, and the CX-5 was not.
Yes, and honestly,
I don't think it was eligible.
I did just see that refreshed one. They brought it up to New England. They had a nice little dinner for us, and they let us crawl all around one. the refresh, it's they did a lot of work on it. It's not just a nose job.
It's a nice refresh.
You drove it.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice.
It's
a big jump.
It is. It's funny because it's like they changed a lot of the vehicle. They essentially, you know, they did a ton of work on it, although it looks very similar to the car that it replaces, you know, with a new nose. It's more than that. And they added another trim level, too. They added a touring trim on top of it. So, honestly, it's a competitive product. And like, Honda has some of these, like, sort of sleeper products in certain segments, right, where, I don't know, it's almost like it's popular to dislike the CR-V, and if you need that kind of vehicle, it's hard to not like the CR-V because it is a very good package of everything. So,
yeah, there are a lot of good new, you know, crossovers this year, though. I think the Lincoln MKC is actually a surprisingly good vehicle. I don't know if they got the chance to drive the Nissan Murano.
I don't think anyone has. I did. Nissan. You've driven it?
I just drove it. Yeah.
When's the launch? Has the launch
happened? No, it won't drive. The embargo is mid-December.
Yeah, so you can't talk about it other than
I can't talk about it other than the fact that I've driven it.
Yeah, because I was with Nissan yesterday at the MPG track days, and I said, when do we? And he said, oh, that'll be another while. So, you know, we all crawled around the Murano at one of the shows. I think it was, Chicago or when was it? But it looks promising.
It does? But
Chris won't tell us about it.
I won't tell you how it drives.
Don't tell us.
Okay.
Because then we'll let you early the next time.
It drives like a Murano.
You'll figure. The GLA, I drove that too. I was surprised. I tweeted about this. I actually said that I sort of expected that car to be a really cynical marketing ploy. Just because it looks just like a raised hatchback and, you know, it's going to be expensive and all that. And it actually drives pretty darn well. And I drove the 45, which is just a ridiculous vehicle.
We have one of those the 45? That's the AMG one, right? Like the CLA? Yeah. We have one of those in the fleet here. And I walked by it actually at that Honda event. And I looked at it. And I was like, wait, what the hell is that thing?
Yeah, it's hilarious. and it's really fun to drive. They're going to sell like five of them. But it is hilarious fun. It's like a grown-up WRX STI, you know, for those with more money and want a badge and all of that. That's kind of what it feels like.
I have a GLA 250 coming a week from today.
It's not a bad vehicle. It's roomier inside than I thought it would be. The interior feels better. Again, not cheap. And I drove that in a Q3 back to back, and I think I still like the Q3 better. But there's some good stuff out there this year.
Well, that's a very competitive market. It's overtaken sedans. So
yeah,
everybody's going to have one until we decide that we like the next best thing, and who knows what that's going to be.
I'm a little surprised maybe they didn't go with something like the Macan, which I have not driven yet.
Well, but the Macan, I mean, honestly, it's an interesting sort of everyman choice, right? Because you could say the Macan. But
yeah, that is not an everyman choice. Or the Outback.
Hey, well, I mean, the...
When's the last time a low-volume manufacturer like Porsche won a Motor Trend Award?
I don't know. When did they have all the full page ad spreads? I mean,
I don't want to say this. We'll talk about this stuff in private, but I don't think the Macan was eligible, if you know what I mean.
I think they're past that. At least I'd really like to. I know that they had a questionable past with that stuff. I don't know that they do that anymore.
Well, I mean, they did and they didn't too. Like, it's fun to throw rocks, but really, we all live in glory. Houses, but and
the Model S won Car of the Year in 2013,
right?
And that was
Elon Musk, and I mean that was, you know, if I had a magazine, I would name the Tesla to my, you know, Car of the Year. Also, I mean, that's great publicity. He's gonna
and you go back further too, though. Like, the Car of the Year was limited to North American cars for quite a long time. For most of that Car of the Year thing, and they had import Car of the Year was this whole like separate thing, and then they merged them. So you had some wacky choices depending on what was new.
the Macan is really, really, really good, Chris. I mean, you'll be blown away.
I'm looking forward to it, but I hear it's really expensive. So
it's I was going to say there were a couple more releases, but it's really, really expensive. And in the big picture, the CRV is going to make a lot more people happier.
Oh, of course. Of course it is. It's not even close. But they didn't shy away from the Evoque in 2012. So they're you know, amiable to overpriced, really small crossovers for premium brands. They're not averse to that. I don't know.
I just hear Macan, and I'm like, pecan. And it's near Thanksgiving.
Oh, come on. Look at all the other names they've got. Yeah. Ridiculous.
No, I just want pecan pie now. And that gets me to actually like our next question. We had a guy write in a couple weeks ago asking about a car for tow. I think, Mike, you were on about a car for towing his barbecue kit. And so we suggested a couple of things. Nope. I suggested the Kia Soul.
Towing?
Yeah, the Cherokee came up. Because it's like how heavy can
you're towing like stuff? 500 pounds, right?
No, it's more than that. So one of those big oil drum sort of deals. That's more than 500 pounds.
It can't be that heavy. The Soul can actually tow a couple thousand pounds. I think it should be fine.
They could carry the Pope. It's okay.
The Pope. No, but they... we suggested the Cherokee as well, so he's looking at that, and he has a follow-up question. What's with the manufacturer's towing recommendations on U.S. cars? And I've actually noticed this too. When you look at the tow ratings for the same car, like in Europe, it's higher than the tow rating for the car here in
the
U.S.
Conservative. Legal and, issues. Conservative.
Yeah, I think that's the answer. Yeah. And as an aside, he can ship barbecue to us, but winter's kicked in Seattle, so he's waiting to spring to cook again. So.
What else did you guys suggest other than the Soul?
I was not on that podcast, Chris. I would not suggest the Soul.
That's a really weird one. Because I'm sure can tow the 2000, but really, I mean, that vehicle is not a particularly fleet vehicle, you know, vehicle to begin with. Do you really want to strap 2,000 pounds to the back?
Yeah, I forget why I landed on the Soul, but there was some sort of set of parameters that we were working within.
You mentioned Cherokee, too, which is probably much better at towing, but the fuel economy is not that great.
It's going to be bad with towing anything. Yeah. Like, I mean, it'll be okay, but I think one of the reasons was fuel economy in terms of, like, a crossover-free kind of thing that can tow and get decent fuel economy. I was like,
Chris, we go to Germany.
Get a TDI Golf, man.
I was going to say, that's where I was going. I said, we go to Germany, and you see TDI Golfs towing like little campers.
Okay,
not even little, like big campers.
I mean bigger
than
the Golfs.
They use cars to tow small
bigger
campers.
Bigger than the Golfs.
Okay. Yeah. All right, so here, I've got the question.
TDI
All
Golf, right? There's my answer.
No, he's looking for advice. His wife and I currently – not his wife and I –
Wow. this podcast took a completely different turn.
Nothing to do with this guy's wife. But he and his wife share one car, 2009 Honda Fit. It's been perfect. He's starting to become more active in competitive barbecue. And spacious as it is, he can't hold quite everything that he needs for a competition. So he's looking for a second car. The ideal solution is going to be something that can tow a small trailer. However, starting to read specs, cars simply aren't rated to tow much anymore, which is true, and I think it's a liability thing. So he's saying like Subarus top out at 1,500 pounds, the empty trailers about 1,000 pounds. He's looking for something that can tow at least 2,000 pounds. Would feel more comfortable if it could do more. Also prefer a hatch. Looking for gas mileage, highway comfort. Looking here, so he's saying I started out with the Crosstrek. moved on to the CX-5, the Cherokee, the Escape. All can tow 2,000 pounds. If 2,000 pounds is enough, CX-5.
If you need the all-wheel drive, why would you get the Tiguan over a Golf?
I don't know.
I think the towing ratings can be higher.
No, on the Tiguan?
I don't think it's going to be that much higher. And frankly, do you really need it if this barbecue rig is 1,000 pounds?
I would go with a Golf TDI.
It's more than 1,000 pounds.
I would go with a Golf TDI.
And the rear suspension is going to be the same on this too anyway. So.
Or a sport wagon Jetta if you need a little bit more in-trunk space. But I'd rather have the newer Golf dynamically and in terms of refinement and all of that.
Okay.
Which, by the way, that is a all the way soup to nuts TDI standard four-cylinder and GTI. That is one heck of a vehicle.
Well, I mean, we solved that one twice.
And we mentioned GTI again.
Yeah.
Bang.
Yeah.
I mean, the reliability, again, I always wonder about that, but that is a really nice vehicle.
All right. So let us know what you get. I want some barbecue in the spring. Let's go. Beef jerky. Can we do beef jerky? I love beef jerky. Like, let's do it. Mike, can your wife send me muffins, by the way?
Delicious, by
the way. Thanks. She sent you and cookies. I get
here,
cookies.
You know, I'm sitting here with water.
Right?
Here's a tip, by the way. She makes a whole bunch, and then we freeze them individually in little baggies and then drop them in the kids' lunch. And they thaw out during the day, and so the kids get a fresh muffin.
That's nice.
So sweet.
That is. I'm
so saccharine. I mean,
I'm wow. Close to vomiting here.
All right.
That's what a wife will do, Chris.
She'll make you muffins. Gosh, that sucks.
We're not going there.
My might as well be wife made me lasagna today, so that was good.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right.
Whose wife?
My might as well be wife.
Oh, nice.
The closest we're getting.
All right. We got another question here. This one's from email. Need some expert advice. He's been in charge of Jamie is in charge of thinning the herd as his vehicle collection is a little too intensive. They're in Killington, Vermont, first of all, ski country. So they've got a 2005 STI, 2006 E30, 2006 E90 330 XI manual sport package. 2011 TDI wagon. Of course, if you're in ski country in Vermont, you have a 90 Westphalia Vanagon and a 91 4-liter Ranger. So what do you get rid of?
First of all, congratulations. There's a lot of nice stuff in there.
Yeah, get rid of the Westphalia because the Vanagon, as much as I love the Vanagon, they are pieces of junk. They're just expensive.
I get rid of the. He had a Ranger in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. 91.
Rid of the Ranger.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the Ranger's not worth anything.
Yeah. Neither is the
91.
Like, what you got to do is sell to a sucker.
The E90, the 2006 E90, is at the point where it's going to get real expensive real quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know what you've got that's also real expensive real quick is a Vanagon. Sell that really to a hipster like sucker. Look, my grandfather had one. He bought one brand new, and I liked it.
He says that the Westphalia is untouchable. Anything else goes. So move on.
That's crazy talk.
Well, fine. Look, if he's got an STI of a similar vintage to the BMW, now, granted, the BMW is a great car, but I'm looking, if I'm in his shoes, I want a variety of things. So I would say actually keep the Ranger because it's so cheap that you can just beat the hell out of it and not care. You can throw firewood in the back, whatever you need, you know, potting soil, all that stuff.
They need to tow their boat, and that's what the Ranger's for. So keep the Ranger.
Okay. Yeah, keep it. Keep the TDI wagon for everyday stuff. Keep the STI for getting your yayas out on the weekend.
That doesn't thin the herd.
Well, it does if you get rid of the BMW.
That's only one car. I say get rid of those two. Get rid of the Subaru and the BMW. Ship them. Keep the TDI. You're going to keep the Westphalia anyway because you're nuts, and then keep the Ranger. Good to go.
I get rid of the BMW and the Ranger.
The Ranger. I mean, is it garage space or is it insurance or what? Because you can just put on.
It's a 5-car garage. It's going to have newer cars.
I don't
just
think.
My opinion.
I don't know.
Not necessarily.
I say get rid of the Subaru
space,
and
driveway space,
BMW, or flip a coin and get rid of the BMW or the Subaru, because they're not exactly the same thing, but they're an STI and a BMW are kind of, you get the same kind of thrill, sort of, kind of, maybe not really, but sort of, out of those two. So,
in the interest of financial stability, I would actually keep the STI. And if you need a more refined ride, and space and all that, you can take your newer TDI wagon. So that's what I would do.
Maybe the Westphalia is untouchable because they live in it. Because you can do that sort of thing. It's a camper, after all. I want to know more about this Westphalia now. Has it been converted to a TDI? Is it still a Wasser Boxer? Or is it? Yeah, we do need pictures. Is it a Synchro? Because those things are like. Did they even make Synchro Westphalias? Yeah, I think they did.
They did.
I don't know. That is the hipster car. If you can sell it to a sucker, do it. Like you.
No, because those are going up in value.
I know they're going up in value, so ship it before they crash.
No, I don't think they're going to crash. That's the only thing in his fleet that's going to hold its value well.
Yeah.
Well, the TDI will probably do okay, but I would say hold on to that camper.
Mm.
I agree. Hold on to the camper.
I've been out.
Plus, you know, you got to have something a little esoteric in your garage. It's just, you know, if you're going to have that many cars, you should have something that's
a
fun emotional play.
I mean, that has all the esoteric.
Yeah, keep it.
All right. So let's try to solve another question here. Long commute car. We got a guy writing in, Sean. He's got an hour commute each way. In the middle.
I already know what my answer is.
Yeah, that really sucks. The middle of Atlanta. You should get a helicopter. That's what you should get. 2007 Civic. Would like to see what we would pick if we had to buy a new car. Doing that hour commute every day, around 40,000. No cares about resale or mileage. Must have decent fuel economy. Must function as a main car.
Either a stripped 328. D, do they make that? 320. What's the BMW 3 Series diesel or any of the Volkswagen diesels or an Audi diesel? Just something diesel. That's the best for the open road.
But Atlanta traffic is not the open road.
There's corners there. Corners and traffic.
No, okay, wait. Does he say 1 hour commute? Is that how many
1 hour commute each way. So he's
okay, how many miles though?
Well, it depends. I mean,
if it's a 3 mile commute, then he gets a hybrid or an
Leaf. Right. That's what I was going to say.
Oh, you're right.
He says once he gets out of town, it's all interstate for 45 minutes. So presumably he's moving, although that is a big presumption in Atlanta traffic.
Mm. This is quite the conundrum. I say Chevrolet SS. You can't get it for 40 grand, though. Damn it.
I drove a Chevy SS on the track yesterday. I'd never driven on the track. The thing kicked butt.
Yeah, of course it does.
I was hanging with a Mustang GT.
I want one of those in the worst way. That's like a total family car.
I mean, I was just my jaw was on the ground. I'm like, this thing, and wait till it gets the Magnet Ride next year. I mean, it was a great car.
Yeah, Magnet Ride annual.
Yeah, the brakes held up really well.
What track were you on?
Willow Springs, big track.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm.
Sounds like a good day.
So, but he says like around 40K or less, but
is
no
he
Bentley.
New?
I don't, but see, he's saying like no Bentley Flying Spur. It's like, well, you can get yourself a Bentley for $40,000. It'll be like an 80s Bentley. So you're going to want to figure out, you're going to want to brush up on like fixing electrical problems, but.
And how quickly you're going to need to sell your house to find the parts, you know?
I mean, are they really that?
Parts?
It's got.
Parts is parts, like, man.
European parts in it, right? They're not. I mean, you've got the 6¾ liter engine with adequate power.
And that'll stick around. That'll be all right. But
yeah.
Everything surrounding it.
Yeah, I don't know.
I do not suggest you get a Bentley.
No.
I think you should get something weird.
Or even a VW Phaeton. Don't do that either.
I mean, gosh, those are one of those cars you sit in traffic and then you start hearing weird noises. You're like, no, let's move. I mean, that's – no. I mean, there are a bunch of cool cars, but we need how much utility?
He's looking for something that can reasonably haul the wife, dog, kids.
Passat traffic. Diesel. There you go.
I'd rather have the golf diesel than that.
Chris is just humming.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know.
Save some cash.
Let's see. I'm gonna try to go weird. RX-8.
You can do that for $5,000.
Yeah, right. So save
and
the
bring
40K.
A quart of oil in the trunk, right? For your commute.
Right. RX-8 with a V8 swap. You're still not at 40. All the hilarity $25,000 can buy.
I think he wants. Oh man, I don't know. What I need to know is new or used and body style. That's what I'd like the parameters right. That were helpful.
Yeah,
because it'd be easy enough to say like Mazda 6 or something, but I don't know if that's the right thing if you want something used.
Yeah, I'm making kind of some suggestions. I mean, a Mazda 3 hatch with manual is a pretty nice car. It's a hell of a fun car to drive, actually.
Yeah, fully loaded.
Yeah, and it's a good deal. It's like, you know, you don't have to worry about rust so much and things like that in Atlanta, although climate change may change that. Didn't Atlanta have, like, treacherous snow last year?
I think they had, yeah, they probably freaked out. They had a couple of snowstorms.
Yeah. I don't know. And I mean, that actually, like, something like that or a Mini. Minis can be tremendously entertaining, and you can still haul stuff. If you need a little bit more space, you can get the Countryman.
I wouldn't get a Mini.
Really?
This is here's the reason why. He's talking about an interstate commute. And you're talking about a short wheelbase car with run flat tires. You're not talking about zipping in and out of city traffic. You're not talking about a canyon road. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
I'm with Chris. I would not get a Mini if I had to get on the freeway.
All right. I think that
I mean, that sounds, it's harsh, but
no, I mean, I think that's valid. I don't know that we've solved this. I mean, I
tell him to write back with Sean, write back with more detail here. New or used. If you have any other, like, ballpark suggestion cars that you're looking at, or body style, size, et cetera, that would be
helpful. Right, because, like, what's on the list, what's off the list? Like, you know, a C-Max Energy fits all of that to a certain degree. A Volt, but, I don't know that I'd want to spend any time in traffic in a Volt. It's not pleasant. There's a lot of stuff that's out there. So give us some more parameters. I mean, for $40K, like, that's a bunch of cash, man. You can get yourself a nice CPO E-Class wagon.
Anything.
Yeah.
You can get a 996 911 at that price.
There you go.
You can get a dealer car ELR. Don't do that. You'll hate yourself. Don't do it.
All right. So we need more details on that. Maybe somebody else can write in with some suggestions, because we get that occasionally, and you smack yourself on the forehead and you go, oh, what did I think of that? And then because it's the heat of podcast battle. But I think we've done it for podcast 401. We're in the 400s now. So Chris Pockert and Mike Harley, thank you very much for dedicating some of your evening to us.
Always a pleasure.
We will catch up. It'll be short to get to 402. That's going to happen like within a couple of days. So there we go. We'll see you guys next time.
Thanks, Crap.
You can subscribe to the Autoblog podcast in iTunes, send us an email at podcast@autoblog.com, or find us on Twitter @AutoblogPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.